Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market, a dynamic leader in the quality food business, a mission-driven company that aims to set the standards of excellence for food retailers. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
I'm Chad Pagano, former Army sniper, chef instructor at the Institute of Culinary Education, and an avid lifelong hunter. And you're about to experience the wild game domain from the hunt to the hearth, airing live on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. So today, we're going to talk about foraging. We're going to change gears a little bit here today. Oh, I hear something. Do you hear something? A reading from the book of Genesis. And God gave to every living animal, including humans, all the green things of the earth to eat. God set the first humans in a garden where they could eat from any plant or tree, except the two God forbade. This garden was not a cultivated orchard or a wild place, but it was God's wild place where the food will grow. Thank you. A reading from the book of Genesis. That was good. Thank you. It really made the point. It got us going here. I got to tell you, you know I'm a libertarian. I'm going to admit something else. I'm a Catholic. I wouldn't say the best Catholic. I wouldn't say a practicing Catholic. I go to church on the big days. You know, one of those guys. I know, I have a kind of relationship with God. He's cool with me taking certain days off. And he's like, as long as you don't kill anybody or steal or cheat, you know, you could take a Sunday off and relax a little bit. But, you know, when I was researching the show Foraging, I kept getting into this like spiritual area. You know, I was researching on the internet and you know, there seemed to be a lot of religious kind of tie-ins with this idea of foraging and this sustainable bounty that we have before us. And you know, the best thing about it is it doesn't matter where you live. We're recording here in Bushwick, Brooklyn, and I guarantee within 10 minutes of leaving this studio, I could find something edible growing through a crack in the street or in some backyard garden somewhere here in Brooklyn. So, you know, most of my shows have been about hunting and you know, the hunting of wild animals. And I you know, as far as the circle of life, not to be a little goofy about it, but, you know, I think obviously harvesting your own meat is part of that. But, you know, we should take that further and really consider foraging, or you should consider foraging. And, you know, the beautiful thing about foraging, it, you know, the proud historic nature of it alone, you know, our earliest descendants were hunters slash gatherers who foraged for their food. They were certainly in tune with their surroundings and they ate with the seasons. And that should sound somewhat familiar to you now if you're into the food scene here in the city. You know, even 15 years ago or so, 20 years ago when we had this revolution of eating fresh and eating food that was locally grown, you know, it became so popular. And now, you know, if you're part of that scene, guys like, you know, chefs like Larry Forgione, Alice Waters, these chefs came up and, you know, they said, you know, what makes food in France, Italy, you know, or in Europe in general so good? Why is it so good? And everyone, it's a real simple equation. They eat regionally, you know, they eat locally. They don't order stuff flash frozen from across the country. They use what they have on hand. And then we started doing that here. The chefs finally woke up and said, you know what? We don't have to compete with those great French chefs. Why don't we just use what we have here in the Hudson Valley, right here in the city? You know, we'll get our chicken from upstate New York. We'll get our beer from Brooklyn and develop a menu. And once we started doing that, you know, our food scene changed here in the city. And it should start boiling down, and I think it has, but I think it should really start boiling down to the average, we'll call him the average Joe, you know, on the street. You listening to this show today, you should be out there. I don't care where you live. You live in the city, we'll call it something cool, okay? We'll make T-shirts and everything, urban foraging. Go to Central Park. Go to a local park. From my research, just a little legal disclaimer, I think it's illegal to pick things in Central Park. But I've heard through certain blogs, and I've been reading up on it, they're kind of, as long as you're not taking 40 pounds of mushrooms out of the park, no one's going to really care if you forage a salad. But, you know, it'll be a way for you, for us, to reconnect with nature and show, you know, and find this food that's really all around us. So it is one of the oldest and most basic sustainable activities of humankind. And we live in this world where, unfortunately, these skills are being lost. It's kind of like a missing link in modern civilized cultures. It's this direct physical connection in the form of food, you know, subsistence, what we need. Nothing is more primal than that, right? And this brings us to our deepest appreciation and understanding of the world, of the natural world. So, you know, I did the reading, and whether you believe in God or not, the Bible, you know, it doesn't matter. That reading is true on some levels. This earth provides for us. So the reading can teach us, you know, some real-world lessons for coming closer to nature, and that's what foraging, to me, is really about. Yeah, it's about surviving and eating, and I'm in no way one of those kooky survivalists. But, you know, just having the knowledge that there is food in your backyard, knowing that what types of plants you could eat, you know, figuring out their flavor profiles. This is a real undertaking. It's going to, again, put you in tune with the earth, with everything. You know, and there's no cultivation. Now, listen, I support our farmers, our mom-and-pop farmers, and we need them. They have to farm. But, you know, to actually get your food without any form of cultivation, it's in your backyard. Right now, if you walk outside, if you do have a backyard, I guarantee there's dozens of edible plants available to you. You know, the first one that comes to mind for me, being Italian, dandelions. They're everywhere, right? It's springtime, spring is in the air, the dandelions are going to start popping up. You can make an awesome salad, and we'll talk about that at the end of the show. I have we'll call it a recipe for kind of a foraged green salad, but we could include dandelions in that also. You'll be surprised to find garlic mustard, chicory, even plantains in your backyard. Never mind walking around your neighborhood, right? Wild apples, pears, grapes, berries. You know, there's even a cherry tree in the local park in my neighborhood out on Long Island. You know, beautiful red cherries. So, you know, there's this abundance of food available to us. So in addition to helping people get closer to nature and appreciate it, you know, there is nothing, I can't think of anything right now that is environmentally more friendly than foraging your own food. So, you know, we're all into this food scene and sustainability. I hear all these terms, right? And I talk to people being a chef, and you know, they say, well, I go organic. And that's good. We should try to stay as organic as possible. But truth of the matter is, if you're in a regular, typical, we'll call it supermarket, you know, that organic food has probably traveled thousands of miles, or at least hundreds of miles, to get to your location. So, you know, you could imagine how much oil is being used every step of that process, the harvesting, even for organic, you know, they got to put it in a truck, they got to drive it somewhere. And this, of course, is damaging our environment in some ways. You know, most of us, let's be honest, don't consider our food source. I mean, we see an organic sticker on it and we say, okay, let's grab this. But if we could take this as a movement, you know, foraging as a movement to the next level, we could really do a lot and really make a dent in you know, conservation and sustainability and pollution, global warming. And it all boils down to how many people are really foraging. If you're foraging for your food, you're a part of the solution. You're really helping out. And there's plenty. You can find it. If you spend 5 minutes, 10 minutes researching, there's got to be a locally wild, overgrown area. I don't care if it's a building lot somewhere overgrowing. And you could go and forage at least a salad every day or once a week or make it a Saturday tradition. The beautiful thing about it for me, though, is just getting out there. You know, I find some stuff, find some food. And, you know, it's kind of this combination of hiking. You're almost, you know, in a way gardening. You're kind of connecting. You're out in nature. So there's this exercise almost involved in it. You know, you're all busy going off to the gym. Well, you know what? Skip a day. Skip a Wednesday and go foraging for your workout. Go walk around the park and see what you can find. You'll be shocked at the workout you get. And you know, when I was thinking about this show, you know, I'm sitting here, I sound a little preachy, I think, today, maybe. I don't want to because I'm not that guy. But because, you know, truth of the matter is I'm not this big-time forager. So I do it when I can, and I'm trying to teach my kids, you know, to get out in the woods, out in the wild, and experience it all. Never mind just, you know, the hunting portion of it, but also, you know, what in my opinion, God has given us, or what Mother Nature has given us. You know, I want them to learn about that, and I want them to get out there and start realizing that there's this bounty available to us. So when I was researching this, and you know, as I researched it, I said, you know, I'm going to be hopefully motivating a lot of people to get out there and do it. But there is some concerns, obviously. I don't want anybody to go out there. So this is my legal disclaimer. If you go out there, do something stupid and eat a poisonous mushroom and put yourself in the hospital, in no way am I going to feel responsible. So you have to research this. Don't get up right now and run outside and pick something and eat it. So I'm going to make some suggestions, and I'm going to kind of talk you through the process of how this works. And we're going to start real slow, and we're going to kind of give you an overview of how you do this. Obviously, you know, proper identification of what you're eating is important. You know, before eating anything wild, you know, especially a plant, make 100% sure, 100% sure it's not poisonous. So you're saying, well, how would I know that? You know, well, there's a couple of tricks to it. The first thing I would say is you need to buy a book. You need to go out and forget the internet. Forget it. Don't even bother. There's a million different opinions. You need a guide. There's a great guide called the Foraging Guide to the Northeast. And it's a little pocketbook, and it has just about every edible plant available to you in the wild of the Northeast. I found it hugely important to have this book on me when I started foraging. I have, you know, as you know, from hunting, I have access to properties, and I see, you know, beautiful green vegetation all over the place, never mind mushrooms, morels, all sorts of stuff in the spring in the woods. And I decided, you know what, I got to start identifying some of this stuff. And it started for me, like, just leaving the woods, and I'd come across a mushroom patch, and I would say, page 8. Oh yeah, these are edible. These are delicious. I pick them, fill my cargo pockets, and get home and prepare them. And there's nothing like, you know, preparing a dish of wild venison or something an animal you harvested with these wildly foraged mushrooms or greens or root vegetables, all of that. You know, we gotta make sure we have some kind of reference point. So, you know, I would suggest one of the guides. You can find them at, I think I picked mine up at like Barnes & Noble. I walked in when I decided I'm an impulsive guy. When I decide to do something, it happens overnight. So I like ran in, first book I grabbed. Hey, this is about foraging, and I live in the Northeast. Let's buy this one. And it worked out great for me. When we come back, we're going to take a short break here. And when we come back, we'll talk, you know, more about some of the rules or ideas or outline this idea of foraging. So you are listening to the Wild Game Domain on Heritage Radio Network, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Numb by Techstar on heritageradionetwork.org. Today's program has been brought to you by Whole Foods Market. Are you a locavore? Our Northeast regional forager for Whole Foods Market sure is. She spends her time traveling around the New York City metro area sourcing the best new or interesting artisanal and handcrafted local products for our purchasing teams at the local store level. Part of our commitment to our local suppliers includes assisting them with the process of getting their products sold at our stores. Whether it's suggesting packaging designs, pricing, or distribution methods, she's helping some of the area's best new products reach savvy shoppers at Whole Foods Market stores. Today, New York. Tomorrow, the world. For more information, visit WholeFoodsMarket.com.
Hey, welcome back to the Wild Game Domain on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We're talking about foraging today. So, I said we were going to kind of outline this now, and I want to kind of give you an overview of some of the things that are, I wouldn't call them concerns, but considerations, things you need to consider before getting out there, because, like I said, proper identification before eating anything out there. Make sure you're 100%, 110% sure that it's not poisonous. Truthfully, there are very few dangerous plant lives in our area, species of plants that are poisonous in our area, in the Northeast alone. So you're probably going to get lucky, but I don't want anybody to take that chance. So, a good foraging guide, book, something like that. Again, I recommend not using the internet. There's some great sites out there, don't get me wrong. But you don't know where he is. You don't know what he's talking about. And the problem arises that we use these common names for plants. One that comes to mind is, let's say, chickweed. We've all heard chickweed, and you've probably seen it on some menus in restaurants. You know, there's so many variations of chickweed, and some of it actually happens to be poisonous. So through your guidebook, or really even better, through a mentor, if you could find someone into foraging that you could connect with, and there's some classes available in Central Park, if you do a little research, there's people who offer tours in areas, especially upstate, where you could do a 4-8-hour class on foraging. What you'll see in the guidebooks, a lot of times they'll give you the common name and the Latin name for that plant. And the Latin name is going to generally be a lot more accurate in identifying that picture to that plant. And then when you see that plant, you're less likely to have someone tell you, oh, chickweed's fine, and any form of chickweed's okay. So we just want to kind of classify them in smaller blocks to identify them. The main thing for me is you got to, and this comes from being in nature, you're going to use all your senses. You know, last week we kind of talked about stalking techniques and how to get out and on, how to hunt animals. And, we talked about using our senses. The more time you spend in nature, the more these senses are going to almost come alive in you. You're going to start really smelling and tasting and seeing a lot differently than you do here in the big city. You don't want to limit yourself to visual ID alone. A lot of wild edible plants have, like I said, lookalikes. So you got to learn the difference between similar plants by how they smell, feel, the texture on them. It's not a rule, but in many cases, poisonous plants are unpalatable really by their smell alone. So the sense of smell could help you. And you shouldn't be really, I'm saying senses, taste really is important here, but should only be used if you're absolutely sure it's not poisonous. Obviously, you can taste a little bit of it and see if it appeals to you. Some plants, and another example, a water hemlock, and you've all seen these. you know, the water hemlock, you know, in these ponds. Go to Central Park, you'll see them, the, you know, the green. A lot of times we confuse it with what we typically call lily pads, right? Water hemlocks. You know, they're an example of a plant that if you take the smallest amount, it could be deadly. And I'm talking about, you know, a little piece of the leaf could kill you. So, you know, you have to be careful. And you got to learn your habitat. You know, we don't have the means to forage all over this great country of ours for the most part. So focus on one lot, one park, figure out what's growing there. And you'll be surprised how quickly you'll kind of find the pattern of these sustainable foods that are available to us. You know, things like you won't find cattails on high slopes and you won't find ramps in swamps. You'll start figuring the terrain that you're working in. And you'll start seeing what we call, you know, clusters within the foraging community. We use the term clusters of these beautiful plants. And sometimes they're called companion plants. Many plants are commonly found growing nearby certain other plants. So if you find this plant or this tree, you know you can find something else. So we're looking for these patterns. You know, I'm looking for, as an example, you know, I want to find yellow dock for my salad tonight. Well, you know, if I can find pokeweed, I know there's yellow dock close by. So, you know, this will all come from just being out there, learning, getting your guidebook and going page by page, you know, and learn to follow these wild plants through the seasons. This is important, obviously, for a couple of reasons. You know, the first is positive identification. When I first started foraging, I misidentified the poisonous white snake root as another plant. And luckily, I was with someone, and he was like, "No, that's a, you know, that's a wood nettle." And I said, "Oh man, I almost ate that, and that would have been real bad. I probably wouldn't have died, truthfully, but I would have made myself nice and sick." You know, and I was planning on making a wild green soup. I was going to do this whole thing with it, and I had a bundle of it. Luckily, you know, I had a friend with me, so you got to be careful with it. So seasonality will really help you identify what's available to you. Other reasons to follow wild edible plants through the seasons is to locate perennial plants that you want to harvest in early spring. It's springtime now, so now's the perfect time. So my example is by the pokeweed. You know, by the time it becomes identifiable completely, it's often past its point of use. So if you know pokeweeds are coming in the spring and the early development of the pokeweed, you can find it very easily. Once it starts flowering and doing everything else, it really becomes unedible. So there's these windows that we have to work within. And, you know, if you make a note of it during the warmer months, you'll know where to find it, obviously, in the spring when it's ready. You know, and this is like harvesting your own wild edible plants. And, you know, within that too, sometimes the whole plant is not edible. And again, a guide or a mentor will help you with this. So you got to learn which parts of the wild edible plants are safe to use. Just because a wild plant is considered edible doesn't mean all parts are edible. An example of this is while the ripe cooked berries of elderberry are safe to eat, the bark, stem, and roots are considered poisonous. Another big one everyone knows is the rhubarb, right? Excellent. You know, we're going to get into summer here soon, and we're going to have rhubarb pie. Well, the leafy greens of rhubarb are poisonous. The stalk itself, delicious. You know, the bitter texture that comes from that in a strawberry rhubarb pie is nothing better in the summer. It's also important that some plants are only edible at certain times of the year. You know, so, you know, fiddlehead ferns, you know, some of the fern plants are going to be edible in the spring, but not in the fall. So, you know, and they stay green basically all year in our environment here. So you got to just be careful of this. You know, that's my legal disclaimer to you. But get out there and enjoy it, people. I hope I'm not turning you off. You're like, "I'm not doing this. I'll just go to Whole Foods," which is not a bad option too. But Start slow. That's all you have to do. You know, here we go again, the conservationist in me, because I got to lecture you about conservation. Now, obviously, you know, picking your own wild greens is going to help in the conservation of you know, the earth in general, you know. So don't over-harvest. Don't be a pig when you go out there. You don't need every wild mushroom you come upon. Leave some. You know, every population out there, I don't care if you're in Brooklyn or in the Midwest, Hudson Valley, you got to think that that population of whatever you're harvesting is limited. And that's how forage, you know, that's the overall mindset to foraging. There's only a limited supply. Take what you need, eat fresh, eat it right out of the woods, use it that day, and then move on. Forage the next day. Even where, you know, wild plants occur in large numbers, we got to respect that plant colony. We got to make sure it's there for everyone, and that it's healthy and it's going to thrive through the year. So, you know, I have a general rule of thumb. I try not to collect or forage more than 10% of what's available there, you know, 10% number. And that depends on how much, you know, pressure is on that area too. You know, we talk about hunting pressure all the time. How many guys are hunting in a given area? Well, how many people are foraging in an area? Believe it or not, if you get into this culture or this way of life, you're going to be shocked at how many people are foraging out in Central Park. You're going to run into them as you're walking the paths. So use that 10% rule. Don't take more than 10% of a plant or of a population of plants. And that will give you plenty, believe me. You know, there's no way to really measure it. We're just kind of eyeballing it as you go through. Obviously, never forage rare, protected, wild, edible plants. There's a lot of them out there. Many plants, you know, are locally abundant, but then rare in other places. So we wanna protect that. Only collect the part of the plant that you can use, plan to use. You don't have to harvest or pull the roots out, the whole thing. That plant will replenish itself, you know. Don't uproot the whole plant. If we're using the leaves, trim the leaves from the plant. And here's the best part of this, and we're almost out of time here, but, you know, I was giving this some thought, and, you know, where I live out on Long Island, it's you know, it's kind of like keeping up with the Joneses. I got to mow my lawn. I got to make sure everything's green. I got to plant my flowers. You know, do some research. And I made a promise to myself that this year I'm going to cultivate my own wild edible plants. I'm gonna have a wild edible garden, and that's something you guys could do in Brooklyn, right? That's something you could do right here in New York City. Many wild plants that are edible are easy to transport, and so you can find them in the wild, dig them up. Ramps are a good example. Are getting scarce due to over-harvest. Everyone wants them. They're delicious. They're easy to grow in the right conditions. So, you know, consider this idea of creating your own wild garden almost. I want to give you a recipe. Maybe get you started here. I was thinking, what can I do? It's accessible, simple, easy. Get people, break them in, easy to this. First step, go get your guidebook. Go harvest some greens, green leafy vegetables. In this recipe, I like to use like garlic mustard greens. They got a spiciness. They got a real earthy kind of flavor to it. And I thought, well, I could teach you to just, I could give you a recipe where you just saute them up and you know, serve them as a side dish. But why don't we make them part of a meal? And I was thinking frittata, you know, a nice frittata. It's good any time of the day. You can have it for breakfast, lunch, dinner. So this is my idea for a frittata. We're going to need about 2 or 3 eggs, about a tablespoon of olive oil. Chef Chris is in here, my co-host, who loves canola. So I'm going with the olive oil, Chris. A pinch of salt. Get some mushrooms, either foraged or you could go, you know, buy something organic. Whole Foods would be a great way to go there. Pick up some beautiful mushrooms. A red sweet onion. Half cup of red bell peppers or any kind of pepper you like, and we'll chop those up. 1 teaspoon of rosemary. half cup of garlic mustard greens. I would probably put more than that. You know, the whole thing, a half cup, what does that mean? You know, I don't know. You're going to pack them in a half cup. You know, use a big handful of nice garlic mustard greens. If you want to wash your greens, if you're getting them, you know, if you foraged them yourself, you want to wash them, you know, wash them nice, dry them, blot them dry a little bit. And so what we're going to do here, we're going to preheat the oven to 350 degrees, whisk the eggs, nice, set them aside, heat the oil on, you know, medium, high, in a saute pan, appropriate size saute pan, I don't know, something 6 to 8 inches. Add the onions, pepper, and mushrooms, and you're going to saute that until the onions have caramelized. You know, you're going to go to medium heat here, and you almost want the onions to kind of gelatinize. They're going to get real. They're going to almost get translucent and soft, and then the edges are going to start to brown. That's when we're going to bring out the real flavor. Add the rosemary to the pan, and just stir this in quickly. Rosemary is going to release its flavor real quick. So kind of get them into the onions, stir them up real quick, and then immediately get your eggs right over that. Dump your eggs that you beat up already right over that. At this point, add the wild greens and cover everything up. Lower the heat to medium and cook, you know, with the cover on it for about 2 minutes or until the greens are wilted. At that point, just kill the heat. All right. Leave it there with the cover on for about another 3 to 5 minutes and let it kind of steam everything. Remove the cover at that point and place it in your oven, the preheated oven. Place it in the oven for a few minutes, and this will kind of crisp up and brown the top of your frittata. And you're going to probably have it in there for about 5 minutes. You're going to let it sit for a couple of minutes after taking it out of the oven. And just let it rest, you know, 4 or 5 minutes, just rest in the pan. Run a knife along the edge of the pan, invert it out onto a plate, flip it back over onto another plate so you have that nice caramelized size. You'll see the greens on top and everything. And you'll have a, you know, serve with some nice rustic sourdough bread or something like that. And I think you'll have a nice dish, you know, really to make any time of the year. And it will give you a nice intro to foraging in general. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. So I'd really like to thank my man Jack for producing and engineering today's show. As always, you can find the archived episodes of the Wild Game Domain from the Hunt to the Hearth on the heritageradionetwork.org. Thank you, guys. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.